Chapter 26. Colmar. On the third day, he finally said, "Got me in a town called Erford, not too long agone." We'd already traveled for hours that day while he walked behind our cage, but he spoke easily. Like most of us, Geffen had grown up hard. If you gave him a pick, he'd go for 2 days straight before asking for water, I bet. "Turned you out of an alehouse?" "Nah, was a fire. Lots of commotion. Folks running all directions. Recruiters was in town, though I didn't know, and came around to help the fire line."
"You were on the fire line?"
"Nah."
"Well, how'd they get you then?"
"Was in the building on fire."
"Well, that was stupid," I said. I was not in a good mood.
"Hey?"
"I said it was stupid."
"How's that?"
"Well, when a building kindles, you typically find a way to exit, don't you?"
"Oh, I was trying, sure. Heard someone in there, though."
"You heard?"
"Sounded like a screaming child."
"Oh.
And they pulled me out."
"Oh." I watched the hills roll by a while. The country got flatter as it traveled further south, I remembered. It seemed every hour that the hills were just a little bit lower. Lower still, until you couldn't call them hills anymore. Pretty soon the land just swelled and buckled, but that was as far as it came. The four great rivers and their tracery of diverging veins, and mila after mila of farmland. The four great rivers and their tracery of diverging veins, and mila after mila of farmland.
Further to the south, I saw Erda's heart, perhaps larger than I remembered. And along the Ruhr, there were many mills, all of them with enormous wheels churning through the water. There was more on the river, I soon realized. I hadn't paid attention to much more than the wood between my ankles for a while, and even so, those wheels were still pretty far south. There were bundles of logs as large as flatboards being floated down the Ruhr, logs still wearing their bark. Several men rode atop each of them, all holding long poles. They pulled their way along the currents, one log ship after the other, in a great line coming from the north. That line seemed almost as long as Erda herself, and you couldn't see the end of it as it wrapped around the far bend. The men on these bundles pulled them toward different mills along the Ruhr at random, so far as I could tell. And as I watched, I could see other bundles appearing from the other side of these mills. They seemed to appear from underneath the docks, and I understood that the mills were built out over the water. They must have had a hole in the floor. Sawmills, then, all of them. I wondered if they were bothering to put the planks they produced onto true flatboards, or if they just floated the raw wood toward Colmar, extra moisture be damned. The bundles of planks that came out of each mill were enormous, and it was impossible for me to see how they sat in the water. I wondered at first why we'd not been loaded into boats to take us to our destination that much faster. But looking at all that lumber choking up the Ruhr, I understood. There was a whole army of men and women both, and sometimes the small, rapid darting of children crawling all along the bundles, leaping from top to top, holding large poles tipped with iron hooks. They would dig these into the wood bundles and push or pull to break up any blockages. It took many of them to move a single bundle along, and the entire Ruhr, as far as I could see, was swarming with people carrying hooks.
"What about the kid?" I finally asked.
"The who?"
"The kid you thought you heard. Did they get her? Him?"
"No."
"Got you, though."
"Yeah."
"God damn it."
"Goddamn you too, Geffen." "It's okay. Take no offense at your crack about the alehouse."
Shut the fuck up a while.
We came to Colmar's gates sooner than I'd planned. I didn't like them. They didn't look quite the way I remembered, and seemed to push out into the countryside much further than should be allowed. Eventually, we came to a great serpent of people lined up at the north gate, stretching back so far from the city that I suspected those people wouldn't see the inside of the gate before the following day. The line didn't seem to move at all, and there were many people who'd simply pulled their wagons to the side and made camp. We didn't have to wait at all, though. We were apparently special.
The captain just said a few words to one of his men, who blew into a horn and started screaming at some other men. And all of the men who he'd screamed at pulled out short whips and began to lash these people out of the way so that we could pass. We had to slow down to a crawl so that these men could lash each person meticulously, as if any peasant mistranslated into a lash for the recruiter. And they all appeared to be thorough, deliberate men. Sometimes I tried to apologize to some of them as we passed by, but they wouldn't look at us. I remember at one point that someone threw a turnip or something at Geffen as he shambled by, and then one of the horsed recruiters was off like an arrow, plunging into the masses, and a few moments later he came out again dragging a man by the collar of his shirt. I heard the sound of screaming, crying women following behind, but did not see where this sound came from. The recruiter marched him into our main column, where he was received, and soon disappeared. Nothing was thrown at Geffen after that incident. The only thing any of them really seemed to notice was Risa. He said very little anymore, locked up in the cage like that. I was very worried about him, I recall, and did not think about much else, so that the sights that passed us by all run together and lose their detail. Always there was the crowd through which we drove, the water wheels, and the wooden palisade surrounding the city. It looked so familiar, that wall, and so wrong, as if it had somehow spread away from the city to claim more of the country. Somewhere beyond that wall, I knew was Ing's fortress. There was the river district that ran through the heart of the city along the Ruhr, which eventually came out the other side to join the ocean. Somewhere inside that city was the merchant tents, the granaries, the many barracks. Somewhere, the tradesmen's quarter. The gate loomed ahead, huge wooden doors thrown wide as the guards moved along the top palisades, and to the left of it was another gate, set right over the Ruhr, and those doors were opened wide as well. The floating skiffs of lumber all floated through that gate, over and over and over, in a constant line, and Komar ate them all. Komar was a low beast with a horrible mouth that was larger than the rest of it, and the mouth gasped out at us like it would swallow it all down. Us, the wood, the country, the people, the livestock, and soil. Everything from which Erda was made got sucked through that gullet and shat out the other end. Pretty soon we were sucked through as well, and I did not like it. It was loud outside the city, loud with the sounds of all the people and the livestock and the creaking of the cage and the many wheels. The dust, the curses and the crack of the lash, the sounds of iron ringing iron and steel ringing steel, the sounds of chopping, the sounds of wood being cut at the mills, the call of the criers, and the smells. So many smells, I'd forgotten them all. You could smell the mustiness of the animals all around, and beyond the wall there were many communal pens for containing livestock, while their owners sought the city magistrate beyond the wall for license to bring their animals deeper. Everyone seemed always to strive to plunge deeper into the heart of Komar, as if the journey to the center could never be completed. All of us were drawn as if by the same undeniable forces that pressed our feet to the ground, always, always deeper toward Ing's fortress. I stood in the cart as we entered into the city to see better, hating it all, and Risa pulled his legs into his chest to watch me carefully. I don't think he liked the city any more than I did.
Are you well, Udo?
Yander.
Who?
Don't call me the other, I like Yander.
There's nothing wrong with
Yander, Geffen, and leave it alone.
Ah, fine. Yander. Are you well, then?
Shut up. I was watching the neatherds inspect the penned animals, checking hooves and teeth. They had assistants that followed them around with pots, and most times the neatherd would nod to an assistant after inspecting an animal, and the assistant would paint a green line down the animal's flank. Sometimes, though this happened less, they would not paint the animal at all. We continued on, though, and they were lost to view. We passed through a merchant quarter I didn't recognize, mostly hovels and lean-tos. All of their wares were laid out on blankets in the dirt rather than tables, and I wondered about that dirt. I couldn't recall any parts of Komar having dirt streets. But then we passed by a guardhouse beyond a barracks,
and later over the biggest bridge I'd ever seen, connecting one bank of the Ruhr with the other. This bridge was something new, definitely. We continued on, and not long after I saw the thing that disturbed me the most. We came upon another wall, a new thing, like the bridge, that seemed to wrap around the entire city. It was made of quarried stone. I began to understand everything after seeing that second wall. Understanding came very quickly, and I didn't know what it meant at the time, only that it frightened me, and that I did not know why. It used to be made of timber, that wall. Only somewhere between my leaving Colmar and returning, they'd rebuilt it using quarried stone. And I knew, really knew for the first time, that the world was leaving me behind in a way I could not fathom. And at the head of this movement was Colmar. It was like Siksneet's great plowhorse Jarl pulling ahead always, dragging all of Erda behind it, and I standing there watching it go, left out in the darkness. I looked at the stone wall that stretched around Colmar and tried to imagine a people who could build such a thing. I failed. Ing's fortress was as I remembered, though. Set at the southernmost point of the city, perched atop cliffs overlooking the ocean, it stood as it always had. It had a mystical quality that you felt more the longer you looked. An enormous bulwark sitting on the very edge of Teodiscus, every zol a permanent fuck you directed at the gods. The lower support strut of Erda's heart stood over the castle in the distance, erupting from the ocean to climb high into the sky, and I was now close enough that the strut looked nothing like a string, though heartstring is what we called it. The stone wall we'd passed through so long ago seemed to wrap around the entire city and join with the keep on both sides so that you could almost say the keep's curtain wall held the city. It seemed insane to me. You never saw them built in this fashion. There was the inner wall around the keep, always a few layers of timber, then the courtyard, and all aspects of support required by a keep within it. The wall never ran the length of the damn city. Then, as we got closer, I saw the keep had its own wall, too. A smaller one that encircled only the keep. So there was the stone wall they'd built around Colmar that joined with the stone wall they'd built around Ing's fortress. I could not bring myself to accept the idea that these people had built not just their castle, but also no less than two entire walls from quarried stone. I had never before encountered such a large mass of people who had all decided at once to cast who they were away so completely. I felt as though I'd once known the city I was coming back to, only to learn on arrival that the city was no more. The gates to the fortress were constructed from a wood so black it was either permeated with tar or it had just grown that way. I had a very good look at those gates. I could tell you all about them, about how the patterns in their grain were composed of thick black bands interleaved with bands of smoky gray, or how the surface shined as though it had been waxed, or how the iron that banded it was just as black and gleamed with oil as though it had been seasoned like an old skillet, or about how they crashed like thunder if you swung them against the stone into which they were anchored. I could tell you all of these things very well, because our cage sat with the doorway for so damned long while we waited for the line of conscriptions in our column to be processed. They took forever. We just sat there in our cage, Geffen leaned against it while he rubbed the soles of his abused feet, and waited while the idiots inside did whatever it was they had to. We waited there so long I began to wonder if it was the end of our journey. If they'd just leave us there in that dark tunnel for as long as it took for us all to starve to death. When the column began to move again, and then when our cage began to roll again, I was so surprised that I want to say I laughed. But it's hard to remember now if I did. We went beyond the wall then, into the courtyard, and I saw for the first time in my life what the fortress really looked like. Not just the top of it peeking over the city, far away in a district I'd probably never see. It was right there, right next to me, and I could see where it joined the ground and stood immovable, as if it had grown on the spot rather than being constructed. It was enormous.
The stones from which it was composed were each twice the size of a full-grown ox and fitted together so tightly you could almost miss the joints if you did not look carefully. They were gray, like the morning dawn, and twice as cold, and were very small if you looked at all of the keep at once. You didn't realize just how big they were until you stood right next to them. When we were brought inside, I could see that the column of people were being led in a line through the courtyard and out another gate on the other side. At first, I wondered what this was all about, but saw a few moments later that a large table had been set under a canvas shade in the center of the yard, and each man who passed through stopped at the table and spoke to the people who waited there. They had a conversation for a short period that seemed very long to us at the time, after which the man was compelled to touch the table and then follow the line being led through the opposing gate. The processions felt continuous and unending, as if it had been going on since before the castle had been built, as if they built the castle up around these people, and the gates and the walls occurred where they did because these people had always stood there. I wondered how long we would have to wait in that cage. We'd lived in the fucking thing for days and had gotten used to it. But at that moment, when it seemed they would have to let us out so that we could also speak at the table, the cage seemed like getting smaller around us. And as I watched each man pass beyond the far gate after his time at the table was done, I felt the breath in my chest come a little more thin. It seemed we would wait forever before getting to that damn table, which is always how it seems until your time has suddenly come, and then you wonder how your time came so fast. You're surprised that the moment has come upon you so suddenly while you were so busy telling yourself it would never arrive. But when it did come, those fucking bastards wouldn't take us out of the cage. They just spoke to us through the bars.
"Your names?"
said a man who stood at the table. He was very pretty. He had hair like a woman, and skin as soft and rosy as a woman's. His clothing was all very fine and colorful, with large patches of deep purple throughout, and portions of the fabric shined in the light like metal, and others shimmered like water, and he spoke with an accent that inspired me to roll a large rock over his head. "Yander, the large one is..."
"He can speak for himself."
"Please, sir," I said. "He really can't..."
"Risa,"
the giant said. He'd been silent for so long that I nearly came out of my skin when his voice finally dislodged. He looked at the man at the table purposefully with dark eyes that would not blink, and I worried for his health.
"Geffen,"
the one-time sheriff called from behind. He sounded as if he wished not to be forgotten. The pretty man in fine clothing scribbled things I could not read into a giant book. Then he set the quill down, nodded at me, and said,
"Hand."
"My
hand? Give me your hand, simpleton."
He sounded very bored, and I hated him. I thrust my hand through the bars, through the lowest hole I could reach. The pretty man in fine clothing took it by the wrist and stared at the glove that covered it. Then he looked up at me and said,
"You're not a leper. Confess it now, Yander. Our physicians will discover you soon enough."
"No, I'm not. No."
"These gloves, then? They're rather fine for a man so conveyed."
My situation was once much finer than this. They're one of the few things that have been left to me. The man looked into my eyes curiously for a few moments, then thrust my hand at one of the guards who stood next to him and said,
"Remove this glove."
The guard then looked at the pretty man with an expression that could not be disguised, a face that said he both hated and feared the pretty man about as much as you could hate or fear anything, and I felt an instant sympathy for him, whether he'd run a sword through me or not. "It's really okay," I offered. "I'm not a leper, I promise you." The guard nodded at me. When he reached for my hand, I quickly turned it so that the palm pointed up toward the sky, so that the golden diamond Ing had left would be pointed at the ground, and thus hidden from their view. The guard held me by the wrist so that my hand was held out to them, as if I were begging them, the fucking bastards, and removed the glove. Then the pretty man with the quill took something that looked like a small bronze box with a black velvet pad inside. It was no bigger than a man's fist, that box. And he pressed the black velvet pad against my thumb. Then he put the box back on the table. I looked at my thumb, which was now smeared black, and wondered why they'd stained it. But then the pretty man had me by the wrist and was trying to force my hand back over so that they could all see the back of it.
What are you doing, damn you? Stop it!
The pretty man grunted. I resisted them. I could think of nothing else to do. I panicked. It seemed a terrible idea to let them see the diamond in my hand, and all they wanted to do was turn the damned thing over and expose it. I looked down at the book that sat open on the table, saw the long list of name after name after name. Beside each name was a fat black smudge. One of the guards lifted the book from the table and conveyed it closer to my hand, and I realized they wanted to press my blackened thumb against the page. As I write this, I now understand many, many things that were once mysteries to me. I understand what Sunna's throne truly is, and how its magics do so much more than just bring light to Erda. How it powers everything, even the Dwergas that live within the dragon's skin. I understand how Baldovinus's wonderful wheels function, and how the passage of the water is a force that the wheel captures and transfers down a shaft and turns other wheels and gears. I understand how the wheels can do the work of many men, and how they cut log after log, and how the entire line of wheels along the Ruhr, along the other great rivers of Teodiscus, how they all have supplied the timber for Dithmar's navy. And when I sit upon the throne, I understand many things outside of Erda as well. I can see through the outer chaos, through the eons of blackness, which is not truly blackness, but only the absence of light. I see the pinpricks of light beyond the chaos and understand that many of those lights have their own worlds, just as Ing has promised me, just as Erpicia has promised me. Sometimes, if I look hard enough, I can see those worlds. Only when I sit on the throne can I see them, but if I look hard enough, they are there. They are very hard to understand. Their nature is difficult to accept. They are so different to the world I know. It seems as though the people who live on these worlds should be flung out into the chaos as they turn, and yet Erpicia assures me it's all very safe and functional. All of these things I understand, and even when I don't, I still understand them more, I'm sure, than anyone now listening to this book or scroll, record, whatever it should be called. Some of the ship's crew call them files sometimes, though what a book might have to do with a raspy bar of metal is beyond me. And yet, regardless of what I do or do not understand, I've come to accept that I'll never understand why they wanted to smudge the inside of that book with my dirtied thumb. What I did know was that letting my hand be turned over so they could see the diamond embedded into the back of it seemed a horrible idea, and I strained against their efforts.
Helmuth, said the pretty man in a bored voice, if he continues to resist, I want you to cut off his hand. It will be easier to take his mark after it's removed.
Please turn it over,
the guard, Helmuth, muttered at me. He said it as if he could conceal the interaction from the pretty man, though I could see it obviously failed. The pretty man seemed very annoyed with Helmuth. For my part, I was busy panicking. I didn't know what to do. It seemed my two choices were to expose myself or let them lop the hand off, after which I would be exposed anyway. I closed my eyes, sighed, and let my wrist go limp.
What is your profession?
The pretty man demanded. He wasn't even looking at me. He was inspecting his fingernails. For a moment, I felt hope. But it was only a moment. I soon realized one of the guards or the man now holding the small velvet pad would discover what was wrong with my hand and mention it.
Master Pavel, what is the meaning of this?
I hadn't seen the owner of the voice. It was a powerful thing that boomed across the courtyard. Rich and smooth, deep like a cavern. It was a voice that silenced mobs. A wonderful voice. And when you first heard it, you wanted to hear more. You strained to hear it so that even if the owner whispered, there was still the chance to pluck it from the air and let it warm you. It was a voice that had to be heard, undeniable and irresistible. The pretty man, Pavel, I guessed, bowed low enough to kiss his own prick and said,
Lord Hanman, please, gentle, noble lord, how have I offended?
I've been waiting for these men several days now,
I sent explicit instructions that they were not to be mistreated, and yet here they are.
My lord, I assure you.
Why have these men been locked in a cage?
Yes?
Yes? Out with it then, you stuttering, stumbling, drunken, incompetent twat. Pavel seemed visibly shaken. It was annoying. I hated the son of a bitch, but was beginning to pity him anyway.
That is, my lord.
I looked at the man who'd put Pavel so far out of sorts. Hanman. Of course, I knew who he was. Everyone in Teodiscus knew the name of Dittmar's closest advisor, even the hermits who liked to live off in the most remote regions. Even I, a digger from the very edge of the world, had heard of the Lord Hanman. It was the first time I'd ever seen him, and I was not prepared. He was perhaps the strangest-looking, yet most handsome man I'd ever seen. He seemed close in age to myself, whatever age that is, and yet his hair was still thick and black as coal. What hair I had left was patchy, and parts had faded so much that I could no longer recall its original shade of brown. Hanman's hair was as black as pitch, and very straight, so straight that it always appeared to be wet. His skin was pale white, as was the skin of all nobles, and his eyes, which were a blue as bright as turquoise, should have been the most arresting thing on him, though they were not. His cheekbones were prominent and seemed to pull his lips wider and tighter than they wanted to be, so that he appeared to be locked in a pucker. It gave him a thoughtful look, but his mouth settled on his face in such a way that you expected him to have fangs when he smiled. He didn't have fangs, though. I think maybe it would have been better if he had. His actual teeth were impossibly straight and white. Most people lost a few teeth by their 40th year, one or two of the front teeth at least, more if they were a mother. Mine had started to fall out many years before, mostly the bottom row, the ones that had not yet been knocked out anyway. But Hanman had a line of them, as sharp and straight as his chin, and they all gleamed at you when he spoke, or when he smiled, and he smiled often. Really, it was the smile that caught you. It hooked you, like a hook hooks a fish, and pulled you in. And you couldn't resist the fucking thing no matter what you did. His eyebrow had this way of arching when he did it, so that it seemed the lifting of the eyebrow produced the lifting of his mouth. Even when you were infuriated, you couldn't resist that fucking smile. Release them from the cage, idiot.
At once, my lord.
Pavel bowed. I saw guards scurrying around to the rear of the cage with a huge ring of jangling keys. These collars are pretty uncomfortable as well, I suggested. Yes, of course. Pavel, you will see that their collars are removed at once. Any personals that have been seized from these men are to be returned, insofar as these fools have resisted selling off any of it. Move! Damn your bleeding bowels! Did they ever move? I wanted to laugh as they all hopped around like toads, but was unsure how far I could push my luck with Hanman. In the meantime, Pavel was still stuttering like an asshole.
These men were to be... My lord, I'm so sorry. To be taken to the barber and shorn, then conveyed hence to the baths to...
They are to be delivered into my care without further delay.
My lord, of course.
Pavel vomited. He was bowing again, over and over, until I thought his head would hit the cobbles. And then I really did laugh. I couldn't help myself. Pavel looked up at me with a seething hatred that I understood very well. Good, I thought. It made me glad to see his hatred. And just like that, Risa and I were standing in the courtyard of Ing's fortress, both of us rubbing our legs, then taking turns to massage each other's backs and kidneys. Risa was far too gentle with me at first, and I had to let him know he could really lay into me without fear of hurting anything. I'd spent so much time among the rocks it seemed I'd half become a rock myself, and Risa was so goddamned oblivious to everything in the world, I fairly had to take a running start at the small of his back for him to get any benefit from my elbow.
Hanmin waited patiently while we rubbed away the aches and cramps, and Pavel's discomfort seemed to grow as we carried on, which naturally inspired me to make a great show of things and spend more time on each knotted muscle. After a while, I caught Hanmin smiling at Pavel, who seemed near to swallowing his own tongue, and I decided Hanmin was all right. When we were finally done with all that, I took care to bow quite properly to Hanmin, reveling in the knowledge that I did not feel the need to go as deeply as Pavel, and used a voice I'd long forgotten. "My great lord Hanmin, we are at your debt."
"Nonsense, good master. Don't be ridiculous. You were never to be conveyed thus."
"I wonder if a word with the messenger is warranted."
"I assure you, my lord, it was not the messenger who erred."
Hanmin's eyebrows lifted slightly, and I understood that tiny fraction of movement was a thing to be feared.
"Was he not? I wonder. Yes. I think I understand your meaning. We may need to look into this later."
When I smiled, I tried to do so as minimally as the movement of Hanmin's eyebrow. I liked very much how he had moved it. It was a thing I intended to practice later if I ever got the chance. Eventually, Hanmin shrugged as if his concerns for how well his wishes had been honored were a thing he could discard. Or maybe that's not right. Put away, I think. It was as if he could put his concerns away somewhere so that he forgot about them, and then later, when he required them again, they could be retrieved. He knew just where to find them, I guess. It seemed a useful trick.
"At any rate, please come with me. I've had apartments arranged for you in the guest wing. I think you'll find them satisfactory, given my lord."
He'd already walked several paces toward the main dungeon. He turned back to me and waited.
"I'm sorry, my lord, but this man, chained here to the cart?"
"What of him?"
"He's with us, my lord."
Hanmin stared at Geffen a while, and it was impossible to read his thoughts.
"I've had no word of this Geffen, my lord. He's one of ours."
Hanmin kept staring at Geffen, weighing him. Weighing him, it appeared, against every grain of sand that existed in all of Erda. Finally, he shrugged again in that same interesting way and said,
"As you will."
Guards rushed to Geffen's side and fiddled nervously with his collar.
"If all of your concerns have now been addressed?" Hanmin asked.
His mouth was flat and tight, but I think his eyes may have been smiling at me.
"My lord is so kind." I bowed.
"Truly, we are in his debt." Hanmin snorted. It was abrupt, completely unexpected. It was the first time I felt as if it was dangerous to assume I could understand his intentions. It would not be the last time I felt this way.
"Come along, please, Yander," Hanmin said.
He led us to the keep's main entry, walking in such a way that we knew he would wait no longer. Geffen waited until Hanmin outpaced us a bit before leaning close to hiss,
"What by hell's teats do you think you're about?"
"Keeping you out of uniform, damn you," I whispered back. "Now shut your mouth and try not to fuck this up."